This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
Here is the professor, John Clayton. John, as we're getting ready for the draft and we're going over scenarios and you're trying to figure out who's going to go where and who's rising and who's falling and who's really looking at who and who's pretending to look at who, in the midst of all of it, as usual, a couple of kids failed drug tests. How big a deal this year?
No, and it really hurts. I mean, guys like Jonathan Dwyer and McCoy, it just knocks them down because the problem that they face is that, you know, in some ways Dwyer didn't have the great speed, and now he'll drop down even more because of this. And Anthony McCoy, obviously, it knocks him down from USC and in a talented draft like this. And so it hurts. And see, the problem that you have, and I guess in the case of Dwyer, supposedly it's more of a weight loss type of thing, but still, you know you're going to the combine and you're going to be tested. You need to go in clean. And so anybody that fails a drug test from the combine, usually it downgrades them because it's not a matter sometimes of the substance, it's the intelligence. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know you are going to be tested. Don't do anything wrong. And so in a lot of ways, you know, they may not question your character, they question your judgment, and that's where the downgrade goes. And in a talented draft like this, it really knocks you down. So in the case of Jonathan Dwyer and Anthony McCoy failing drug tests, at least according to the reports, that will knock down their value. And, you know, this draft is so strong, it carries strong into the fourth round. And so I have to think with those questions, it probably knocks both players down into the middle of the fourth round or lower, and that's just the unfortunate thing because, you know, again, if they question your judgment, then they're going to question their ratings on you, and that lowers your draft stock.
John, each year it seems like a draft turns on what one specific team does, whether it's at number one, at four, at eight, wherever it may be. I think we're fairly confident we know how the first two or three picks are going to go in this draft, assuming there aren't any trades. Which one is the turning point? Which is the one we have to watch because it sets up everything else?
Yeah, I'd say it's going to be Cleveland at seven. I mean, we can talk about maybe Kansas City at five. You know, do they take an offensive lineman or take Eric Berry? But in a lot of ways, that corrects itself because more than likely there's going to be four tackles taken in the top nine. The wild card in this is Cleveland because if Cleveland doesn't take Jimmy Clausen and you get the idea that Mike Holmgren's a little warmer to taking Colt McCoy in the second round and not take Jimmy Clausen, you know, you don't see a nice fit there because here's Mike Holmgren. He usually drafts offense. And now he's in a position at seven where he's most likely going to take defense. Yeah, they're not going to take a Brian Beluga. They don't necessarily need a tackle. They've got Joe Thomas at left tackle. So do they take Joe Hayden? Do they try to trade up for Eric Berry? Do they try to trade back for Jarek Odrick? Or what do they try to do? So I think in the end, I mean, they're the team that really kind of gets this thing going, because if Jimmy Clausen doesn't go seven, I don't think he goes number nine to Buffalo. I think he goes either to San Francisco or Seattle at 13 or 17 San Francisco, 14 Seattle. But I think the likelihood is, you know, Clausen and the Cleveland pick really control how some of this draft is going to go. And right now, I think Clausen's going to end up in San Francisco at number 13.
John, a lot of comments out there, and a lot of people believe that there's maybe somewhere between three and seven teams in the first 15 that would like to get out of their picks. That Detroit would like to get out of their pick, Washington, Seattle, possibly Cleveland, possibly, I think, Jacksonville. The list sort of goes on and on. What is the market going to be for those teams? If everybody wants to get out, does anybody want to get in?
There's only a couple teams that I think really want to make significant moves, and I'm not guaranteeing that there's going to be those type of moves. I honestly don't see a trade in the top 11. I think we're going to be sitting there at the 12th pick in Miami, and we'll test to see if Philadelphia, Green Bay, or Dallas have the wherewithal to offer the second-round pick to move up, and I don't guarantee that's going to happen. From 12 to 14, I can see there's some possible trade movement. But let's take, for example, Philadelphia. They would be the strongest team because they have 2 seconds and 2/3. All right, so you offer one of your seconds, and you move right up toward the top of the pass rushing. You can take Derek Morgan. But also, too, Philadelphia might feel comfortable comfortable enough at 24 to take a cornerback like Kareem Jackson, maybe take Kyle Wilson. So they may not be a team trading up. You know, Green Bay, problem in them trading up is that if four tackles go in that top nine, then they're not going to trade up for the fifth tackle. They can almost wait to get the fifth tackle or trade back to get the fifth tackle. Problem there. Then, of course, the next team would be Dallas. Dallas would like a tackle and a safety. Maybe they can trade up to end up getting Earl Thomas, but I don't know if they have to trade up to 12. So it's very likely you're going to see fewer first-round trades, a lot of second-round trades, but I think this draft doesn't really position itself for a lot of trades. But still, the value for trades could come between 12 and 14.
John, the other big story, of course, in the NFL, as we talked to John Clayton here of ESPN on All Night ESPN Radio, Mike Salk in for Jason Smith. The biggest story in the NFL over the last few days, other than the draft, has been Ben Roethlisberger and what happened, what really happened in Milledgeville, what's going to happen with him in terms of suspension with the league, in terms of the team, whether they're actually actively shopping him, whether they're just trying to send a message to him. And then in the middle of it all, Jonathan Silver in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette today, just a fantastic article, more of an investigative reporting piece detailing what really happened that night and all the mistakes made by the local police there. What do you make of it all, and what do you think, how does this change what both the commissioner and the team does with Ben Roethlisberger?
Okay, well, let's go for facts, and then let's go for the guessing game of what's going to happen. First off, the facts are that the Steelers are mad and Roger Goodell are mad, and there's going to be a suspension. My guess would be it's going to be 2 to 4 games, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's going to be the 4 games. As far as the facts on the trade, they're not trading him right now. If
John,
somebody
hold on,
then,
just to back up for a second, when you say 2 to 4 games, is that from the league, from the team, or split?
It'll be the league supporting a 4-game or a 2-game, whatever Roger Goodell does, because one of the things that they don't want to have, although certainly I think Ben Roethlisberger has told them that he's not going to question or challenge any kind of suspension, but they're gonna be hand-in-hand with Roger Goodell on this. So that's why I think it gets a stronger position if it comes from the commissioner's office, particularly 4 games, because, you know, a team has the ability to suspend somebody for 4 games, but also, too, it's easier challenged in a grievance when it comes from the player. In this case, when it comes from the commissioner's office, it's hard to overturn because of the new player conduct rule. And I think certainly with the circumstances that are out there, you know, if it's 4 games, I think he's got to, you know, just accept that fact. But as far as the trade front, you know, there's nothing active going on. Now, if somebody wants to call and offer a number one and more, I think the Steelers would listen. But I think the tack that they're taking, and in fact, I know the tack that they're taking, is that he's going to be the quarterback of this team for as many games as he can next year. The next screw-up is going to put him on the trade block, and they'll get rid of him. You know, because remember, if they just want to cut him on the next incident, they can get a lot of money back in signing bonus, or at least try to get a lot of money back, you know, maybe $12 to $16 million. And that's, you know, not fortunate for them. It's not the money. They want the quarterback. So he's got one more chance, but it's going to be a shorter season for Ben Roethlisberger.
All right, he is the professor, I can almost say that word without screwing it up, John Clayton of ESPN. He's getting ready for a big day and night on Thursday. What do you want, all day, John? Are you just taking over the airwaves Thursday?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be all day on TV and all night on ESPN Radio doing the broadcast on Thursday and Friday. So I cannot wait. It's going to be great.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to listening to you and watching you then. John, always good to talk to you. We'll do it again soon.
Okay, thanks.
To compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place, visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
Bring in our NFL insider, Adam Schefter, with the story coming across on Yahoo Sports just a little over an hour ago that the Commissioner Roger Goodell will announce the penalties for Roethlisberger today or tomorrow. Now, Schefter, this comes as a bit of a surprise only because Art Rooney, of the Rooney family, the ownership of the Steelers last week, said that Goodell would not announce the penalties until after the draft. So what's going on here?
Well, you know, listen. Like you, I'm just hearing of the report this morning. I sent out some emails and texts and have not gotten any confirmation one way or another. Now, let's just say for a moment that the report is true, and I'm not doubting its veracity, but if it is true, I was thinking about why they would announce it now. And the only thing I can think of is rather than waiting to announce it, the schedule will come out and they can say, well, you know, Ben Roethlisberger might miss this game, might miss that game. When the draft coverage starts on Thursday night on ESPN and goes to Friday night on ESPN and Saturday afternoon on ESPN, We're not going to be speculating on whether Ben Roethlisberger is going to be spending 2 games, 4 games, 8 games. There's going to be a sense of closure, and you announce it, and you put it behind you. Now, the NFL has been waiting, I know this, for the entire full police report to arrive at its headquarters, and it arrived on Friday. And so if the suspension is, in fact, coming today or tomorrow, and it's hard for me to imagine them announcing it on a day that the league releases its schedule, which would tell me it would be today, if that is the case, then clearly they read through the report over the weekend and were able to reach some conclusions and feel comfortable in moving ahead. Now, I don't feel confident in predicting when this will be announced, contrary to the report. Again, I'm not doubting it. I just have not gotten confirmation of that. But I do feel confident in saying that when the suspension comes down, that it will be between 2 and 4 games. I do feel confident in saying that right now, because I know we've heard a lot of people speculating various numbers on Ben Roethlisberger. I've heard 8 games. I've heard 10 games. I've heard 6 games. I've heard 2 games. But the bottom line to all of this is that Ben Roethlisberger, for all his poor decisions and terrible judgments in the past, has never had a criminal record of any kind. And so without a criminal record, really, in a certain sense, he's a first-time offender of the personal conduct policy. And even in this particular case, he didn't get convicted. He didn't get arrested. He didn't get charged. So I think what you're going to see is a 2 to 4 game suspension. When all is said and done, my guess, and it's just a guess, is it's 3 games. And we'll wait to see whether or not Yahoo is right and it does come down today or tomorrow.
And again, tomorrow, the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, will join us at 8:40 Eastern tomorrow morning. So we'll see what we have to talk about if we're talking about a suspension that was handed down today. And if it comes down as 2 games or 4 games or in that area there, do you expect, in 2 games I don't expect, 4 games maybe, do you expect any kind of an appeal from Ben Roethlisberger if, say, it is a 4-game suspension?
No, I don't, because what's going to happen here, if you'll remember last week, they said, Art Rooney II was very smart in pointing out that Ben Roethlisberger knows that he messed up. He knows that there are going to be consequences. And I think that the best thing that Ben Roethlisberger can do when the league is acting with the Steelers to come up with a punishment jointly is to accept the punishment, talk about how regretful you are about the events that transpired, and move on. That's it, because the last thing you want to do is appeal the suspension to the commissioner if and when he hands it down, when that appeal is going to go right back to him, and it's just going to prolong it. And I think Ben is going to be smart enough here, I think, to just say, okay, it's 2 games, it's 3 games, it's 4 games. I'm disappointed, and I look forward to rejoining my teammates at that point once the suspension is served.
Let me ask you this quickly, though, not from Ben's side, but from the union side. If it's a 4-game suspension, can the union, even if Ben doesn't want to, can the union step in and say, Commissioner, this guy has never been charged with anything, and it's 4 games? You know, we don't want this precedent set. So can the union step in, even if Ben doesn't want them to step in?
Yeah, the union can, and it might. And I don't have the specific answer for you there, Mike. But what's interesting is that I think that, you know, the one thing that I've heard, forget about the union, is from the players. They want to see if this guy's treated differently. And so while the union would be fighting on behalf of its players, I feel like there's a certain segment of the populace out there, amongst players, that want to make sure that this guy's punished rightly. There have been so many people, players, that have been paraded through the NFL offices to meet with the commissioner to get suspended for violating the personal conduct policy. And they want to make sure that Ben Roethlisberger, despite the fact that he's a quarterback, despite the fact that he's won 2 Super Bowls, doesn't get any preferential treatment at all. And so you've got the union, the NFLP, fighting on his behalf, perhaps, when a number of players want to make sure that he pays the price for this. So it's an odd dichotomy there to sort of process.
But earlier tonight, as we talked some hockey, I had the chance to sit down with Barry Melrose of ESPN as some of these games were still going on. And as we looked at the first round, you couldn't help but noticing how even some of these series are, the parity that's existing right now across the NHL, and even how some of the teams that were once the best teams in the league are now starting to be eclipsed by some of the newer, younger teams. In fact, we're seeing a real changing of the guard.
Well, I agree with you. Right now, we've got eight series. Seven of them are 1-1. And Chicago, if they win tonight, they're winning 1-0 against Nashville. All eight series will be 1-1. You know, well, 2-1. We had a couple that started today, like Detroit now. But I can't remember a time that we had all eight series that were 1-1 after the first two games. Parity's here. And you're right. You know, you look at Phoenix giving Detroit all they can handle. It's just amazing, the great young players we have in our sport. Colorado, a team that I thought would be, you know, a powerhouse in two or three years. Right now they're giving San Jose all they can handle. Nashville giving Chicago all they can handle. There's not a average team right now in the playoffs. They're all great teams and are all playing a very good style of hockey. And the thing, the great equalizer in our sport right now is goaltending. Everybody's got a good goaltender.
Well, you mentioned goaltending, and for the team that won the President's Trophy and was the team that was expected maybe to go as far as anybody in this playoffs, the Washington Capitals, that's been their biggest question. They may have all the scoring in the world. They may have the best player in the world, at least in my opinion, in Ovechkin, but they don't know who they're going to use in goal now.
Well, I thought Washington was terrible last night. I thought for 40 minutes they had no chance of winning that game. They're just lucky that for 20 minutes they were able to kick it up, and that Montreal took some bad penalties on them in the third period. Obviously, Theodore was pulled. The first two shots that he had went in. You know, but if you look at those shots, the second goal was right from the middle of the circles, right in front of him, same place that Plekanec scored the overtime winner in game one. So they made him the sacrificial lamb. They brought Varlamov in. He was okay, and he'll start next game, I'm sure, because he won the game, but they got to play better than what they're doing. Mike Green has to play better. Mike Green is one of the best offensive defensemen in the world, but he's given up two terrible goals in front of his own net where he's standing right next to the guy and he just doesn't tie him up. He was on the ice for four goals against in game two. Obviously, Salmon has to show up in this series. You know, it was just, Washington just is not playing a good style of hockey right now. And if they don't start playing better, like I said, I think Montreal will win this series.
Talking to Barry Melrose, NHL analyst at ESPN. Barry, I hosted this show one night right around New Year's, and I made a New Year's resolution for all of America. I thought they needed it, to watch more hockey in 2010, and they responded. Certainly during the Olympics, the entire country was galvanized by watching the U.S. team and the run that they went on. For people that haven't tuned into the NHL in a long time and are maybe thinking about coming back to this sport after enjoying the Olympics the way they did, can you help describe the difference between regular season hockey and the intensity of playoff hockey?
Well, everything just gets better by 100%. You know, everything means more. The players are more disciplined. They work harder. They pay a bigger price. You know, guys, Crosby tonight just leveled Alfredson with a great hit, an open ice hit, a clean hit. Like, Crosby does not do that in the regular season. He might do it in the Olympics, but he doesn't do it in the regular season. And it was a great hit tonight. And what I love about playoffs is guys that never block a shot are blocking shots. Guys that, you know, are won't get the puck out around the wall during the regular season are just giving it everything they got to get the puck out around the wall during playoff time. You know, guys are chasing down icings and trying to make it so that there's not a whistle, things like that. And you know, just to see a guy like Crosby, who is a great player anyways, elevate his game and see Mike Richards elevate his game. And also what's great about playoffs is to see who doesn't show up, who can't handle it, who won't pay a price every night, which team won't pay a price four series in a row, who can only play good one series, things like that. It opens up just so many questions about character and courage and passion and what makes our game great.
One of the great things about, as we said earlier, the changing of the guard and some of the parity in the NHL is that there are now a whole new group of young stars that are really coming up for the first time. The downside of it is that maybe people don't know who they are yet. One of the things I've noticed about the NHL, maybe more than any other sport, is that if you have one of the top couple picks in the draft, they're not missing on these guys anymore. All the best players in the league, for the most part now, seem to be guys who were drafted in the top three. Could you introduce us to a few of these guys?
Well, another thing that is you have to be bad for a while to get good. Mm-hmm. Because look at Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's terrible for a while, and then they end up getting Crosby, Malkin, and Staal. You know, you look at
and Fleury.
So, you know, every team that was bad for a while is getting good. Chicago was terrible for a while, and they end up getting Kane and Taves, Seabrook, Keith. You know, the backbone of their team. But we got some great young players. If you want to look at some of the guys right now that people that are the next guard is Drew Doughty in L.A. This kid's playing 30 minutes a night for L.A. He's playing against Vancouver, a great defensive team. He played on Team Canada at 20 years old. He runs the power play for L.A., which had two goals last night against Vancouver. You got Steven Stamkos, 20 years old, who tied Crosby for the league leadership in goals with 51. You've got this Tyler Myers for Buffalo, the 6'8" giant defenseman who is just fantastic, 20 years old. You know, you've got Duchesne in Colorado. He's 19 years old. He's unbelievable. He scored 23 goals this year for Colorado, and he's having a great playoffs. And you're right, every team that I can go down has superstars that are 20, 21, 22 years old. The future of our, you know, Crosby and Ovechkin are old now. They're 23 and 24. You know, so the future of our league is very, very bright.
All right, in this first round, what's the biggest upset you're looking for?
Colorado, San Jose. Colorado's 0-0 right now going in the second period. They don't fear San Jose anymore. They're going nose to nose with San Jose. Heatley's not in the lineup tonight. That's the biggest upset because of what happened the last 4 years for San Jose and also what happened last year. Number one seed gets beat by an eight seed. You know, if they lose again, they're going to have to take a serious look at completely revamping that team in San Jose. And, you know, that's one of the things that will be interesting to watch if San Jose can respond or if Colorado can continue to play the way they are.
All right, he's Barry Melrose. You can see him all over ESPN and SportsCenter as we go through the NHL playoffs. Don't worry, Barry, my playoff beard looks fantastic. It's good to talk to you. We'll do it again soon.
It's hard to see it on the radio, though.
But it looks good. Trust
me. Well, so I just have to take your word for it.
Oh, it's sharp. It's got a little bit of white and gray in it just so I can look like Scott Niedermeyer.
That's good. Good. If you could play like Scott Niedermeyer, you'd be a rich man.
Thank you, Barry.
Take care.
Buster Olney will join us to look back at the weekend's biggest moments, and clearly this weekend the biggest moment was Saturday night. And what a night it was for the Colorado, the young star pitcher. Remember, we named a member of our staff here.
Yes, we did.
Ubaldo, in his honor, and a very big night. That, I would say this would probably be the second biggest thing he's had happen after we renamed Dan Filippone Ubaldo.
Well, and his pitching coach, Bob Apodaca, gets credit for the pitching coach adjustment of the year. He was really struggling in that game to throw strikes. He was walking hitters. He walked five guys in the first four innings. And after the fifth inning, Bob Apodaca, his pitching coach, went up to him and said, "Hey, why not just try throwing from the stretch? Because it seems like your command is excellent when you do that." He did that starting in the sixth inning, and he locked it down. His pitch count got under control. And his arm is so great, and his stuff is so great, that even while throwing from the stretch in the ninth inning, his 126 pitch was 98 miles per hour. The 128th pitch, the final pitch of the game, 97 miles per hour. He really is kind of a Justin Verlander type guy where the talent's all there. The question is, when is it all going to click in? And it seems like it is in 2010.
Got to be great to be there at a no-hitter and watch that one in person. All right, while we're 11, 12 games into the season, Buster, I mean, the old line is, it's early. But even though it's early, are there some teams out there that still are maybe saying, uh-oh, at this point?
No question. The Red Sox and the White Sox, because in part of who else is in their division. You know, the Red Sox over the weekend absolutely had a brutal series against the Tampa Bay Rays, and it looked like just a mismatch where you have this young, very athletic team against an older team, and the Red Sox looked terrible against them. And, you know, on Sunday, Terry Francona, the Red Sox manager, benched David Ortiz against a right-handed pitcher in Matt Garza, and that told you a lot about where the Red Sox, where Francona feels Ortiz is right now, feeling that, you know, against a hard-throwing right-hander, it's not a matchup that you want. That tells you something about kind of what they're thinking might be. So far this year, Ortiz hitting under 200, 15 strikeouts and 36 at-bats. J.D. Drew's numbers are very similar to that. And because the Yankees and the Rays looked so good early, you have to believe the Red Sox already are thinking about making adjustments, thinking about possible things that they may pursue in terms of player moves. And the White Sox are having the same issue. So far, they're hitting 205. They don't have a single regular player batting over 261. You know, this year, Ozzie Guillen wanted to go with this very aggressive running type offense where they try to steal bases all the time. They don't have as much pop as they've had in the past because Jermaine Dye is gone, and they just don't look very good. And they're chasing what looks to be a great team in the Minnesota Twins. So for those two teams, yes, it's getting late, early, and they have to start thinking about making adjustments.
White Sox getting beat up early this season by your tribe, Gold.
Yep. How about
the
that?
Indians dominating Chicago. Mike and Mike and Buster Olney with us. Interesting story about Cal Ripken and the owner of the Orioles. There had been stories out there that had circulated that suggested that Peter Angelos didn't want Cal Ripken or sort of shunned an offer by Ripken to come become a part of the organization, and then Angelos over the weekend refuting that. Buster, what's going to happen here?
Yeah, I talked to Angelos on Saturday morning, and he said, hey, if Cal Ripken wants to work for us, then I'm all ears about what he wants to do. Now, we know this. He's not going to be the owner because Peter Angelos is the owner. I do think it's someday Cal wants to own the Orioles. He's not going to be the guy who runs baseball operations because Andy McPhail does that. But I think Angelos is basically open to anything else that he wants. And one intriguing thought might be, what about his manager? You know, the Orioles are off to this terrible start, 2-11. Dave Tremblay, who I think, you know, is in a very unfair position. It's a very young team. They're in the American League East. But the bottom line is that the fans are clamoring for change down there. What about Cal Ripken, his manager? Well, I don't think that would be a job he would take. I think his interests are in a higher level in an organization. And, boy, would you want to walk into that job when they're in that difficult position that they're in? And for Cal, you know, he's got a legacy. And would he want to be in a position where his legacy might be damaged and he basically wouldn't be in a position to make all the decisions the way he probably wants to?
That would be a horrible position for him to be in. One of the all-time greats.
Yep.
To go into a team that's won two games, to think that he could go in there and that you snap your fingers is going to turn it around, that would be horrible. Do you think, you mentioned, you know, above a manager, and ever do you think he'd like to be a manager, maybe when the team gets better, or do you think he wants to be above that at all times?
Tim Kirchin knows him a lot better than I do, and he says he does not think that's something that Cal would be interested in.
And finally, Buster, I'm sorry, I want to get to, I hear you. Does not think Ripken will ever be the manager of the Orioles. Quickly, the reason they're having problems and the reason you mentioned the Red Sox are having problems is that both teams are looking up at, right now, two great teams. I know the Twins are also off to a great start, but the Rays and Yankees off to starts where they look like they're going to be the two teams in that division, and the Red Sox might be looking right now like the odd team out.
Yeah, that's right. And the Rays, as we talked about, you know, their pitching has manifested itself, and we showed it in the series against the Red Sox over the weekend. And the Yankees look absolutely fantastic. I mean, right now, they're not getting much production out of their 2, 3, and 4 spots. You know, the first homers over the weekend from Alex Rodriguez and Mark Teixeira. And yet, they're 9-3, and they look like they're ready to go and try to win a World Series again.
Yeah, they played basically all good teams.
Yeah.
They won a series from the Angels. They won a series from the Red Sox. They won a series from the Rays, and they just finished sweeping the Texas Rangers. There's Buster Olney with us every Monday at this time. Thank you, Buster.
See you guys.
Via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, our buddy ESPN insider Tim Kirchin. Tim, a couple of years ago, it may have been last year, one of your, colleagues, Tom Verducci, a great baseball writer, he wrote an interesting column, Tim, about at the All-Star break, you really do have an indication of who's going to make the playoffs and who's not, even though it's a long season. And we know who's good in this sport and we know who's not good. It's the teams in the middle. When you look at a team like the Red Sox struggling now, do you take anything from it long term?
Well, you got to be careful this early in the season, Colin, especially with a talented team like the Red Sox. But with the way they played this weekend and the way they're playing at the moment, of course you have to look and say there are warning flags up now about this team, especially when they're in a division with the defending world champs and the Tampa Bay Rays, who are killing them this weekend and are a very good team. You look at the Red Sox, who haven't had a hit their last 25 at-bats with runners in scoring position. I don't believe they've led for even 1 second of this weekend. Of course, that's an issue, and it leads to what are they going to do long-term this year, meaning are they going to have to go get Adrian Gonzalez from the Padres, go get another hitter for the middle of the order? At this moment, you have to think, yeah, they're going to have to look into that very seriously.
You know, here's what I take. When you look at the Yankees, I mean, Posada's past his prime, and Jeter's supposed to be, but he put up big numbers. But Teixeira's in his prime. Cano is in his prime. If C.C. Sabathia looks to be in his prime, A.J. Burnett's in his prime. But when I look at the Red Sox, their starting staff is in their prime, but Beltre, Cameron, J.D. Drew, Ortiz, none of these guys are in their prime. It looks like they spent all their money on pitching, and they're kind of crossing their fingers a little in the hitting department.
Well, they certainly are, and Ortiz and J.D. Drew are the key guys. Drew's got one hit in his last 24 at-bats.
Oh!
I mean, David Ortiz has not hit a homer. He's got three walks and 15 strikeouts, and he's been benched against right-handed pitching now, at least he was yesterday. That's just not good enough. And being probably a bat short anyway, they were counting on Ortiz bouncing back, and they were counting on Drew having a good year, and that certainly, simply hasn't happened yet, and it's going to have to happen, or else they're simply not going to make the playoffs if they don't get more production from some middle-of-the-order guys.
A lot of people in baseball, Tim, thought Tampa Bay could win this division. I mean, Tampa Bay, the one baseball team that looks like a football team, tremendous athletic ability, probably the fastest team in the division. You know, it's funny, I look at the standings right now, Boston's 4-8, Tampa and the Yankees are 9-3. I still don't think people, unless you follow it closely, I don't think people get how talented Tampa is.
Well, I certainly do, because I've been watching them here a lot for the last few years. B.J. Upton is tremendously talented, and now it appears he's finally figuring out that he's got to play hard every second of every game, and that's going to work in his favor. Their pitching is really good, too. And there's a sense of urgency there that I saw this spring, Colin, and that they know Carl Crawford's going to leave after this season. They know Carlos Pena is a free agent after the season. He might leave, too. So they also know we better win now because next year we're not going to have the same team. So you put all that together with great athleticism and a pretty good starting pitching staff. They're in pretty good shape right now.
Jason Heyward is the best young talent in the National League, maybe all of baseball. Not a big shock. We saw it coming 6 months ago. Put it in perspective. Who are people comparing Jason Heyward? Game-winning hit yesterday. I mean, who? In what context? How great are we talking here?
Well, we've heard Mickey Mantle, we've heard Hank Aaron, Willie McCovey. It's amazing how many people are comparing him to great players of the past. Keep in mind, under age 21, this many RBIs first 12 games. You go back to Mel Ott to find anyone that young who's been this productive this early into a season. That's what we're talking about here. And Colin, I'm telling you, there's nothing to suggest that this is some sort of, mirage. This guy's 6'6", 250 in uniform. He's got the biggest hands I've ever seen. His parents went to Dartmouth. He could have gone to an Ivy League school, meaning he gets it, and he's a great athlete. I did ask him what kind of basketball player he was in high school. He said, I didn't play basketball. I just played baseball. I said, well, you could still dunk it. And he looks at me and goes, well, I can dunk it any way you like. I just decided not to play basketball because I was a baseball player and a very instinctive baseball player who knows how to do things other than hit a baseball 450 feet.
Tim Kirkjian joining us via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. There was a story today. Attendance is an issue. It dropped off last year. The economy, baseball really suffered last year because some overpricing by the Yankees. It took a shot. The attendance is down. Tim, I said earlier, the good teams are still good. The middle teams are still viable. It does feel like since October of 08, when cities maybe that aren't as culturally baseball enriched, the bottom's fallen out. The top are still great. The middle's still very good. I mean, the American League Central, the American League East, really excellent teams. But the bottom seven or eight teams in baseball feel like they've fallen further behind. Do you believe that?
Well, you can certainly make that case, and you can make it from looking at the attendance figures. I live in Maryland. I went to an Oriole game last Wednesday, and there was nobody there on a beautiful Wednesday afternoon with Tampa Bay in town. It's sad. The Indians drew 10,000 on a Friday night the other night, and these are dangerous situations. It doesn't mean, because these are good baseball towns that have been good baseball towns for a long time. So yes, the economy has affected these smaller market teams, and obviously what they have to do is they have to put a better product on the field and start to win a little bit more, but that's not so easy to do when your payroll is a little bit down and the other team's payrolls are up and other teams are just simply much better right now.
Well, and here's the thing is that, you know, I have a friend in New York. He's like, oh, baseball's bigger than ever. I said, you live in New York. Okay, it's easy to say that. You basically, the Yankees are an all-star team. But you bounce around this country, and I've never been a fan of salary caps. I don't like them in any business. But are we looking at a point now that, you know, you've got this group of haves, and the have-nots have fallen further behind. Is it even discussed in this sport to be more competitive financially, more balanced financially?
It is. In fact, it is all the time. It's not discussed with the salary cap in mind, though, because that simply is not going to happen as long as the union leaders are in charge, and they are very much in charge. But this all has to do with revenue sharing and how much the Yankees are giving to smaller market teams, and that's going to come up again at the next basic agreement, labor negotiation. It always does, and there's going to have to be more revenue sharing because you're right, the haves and the have-nots have gotten further apart since 1990. It's unbelievable how big the disparity now is between the big and small market teams. It's been like this a lot of years in baseball history. A lot of years teams come in saying we have no chance to win. But in some cases, when you're the Kansas City Royals, it can be a little discouraging knowing our payroll's down, our team is down, we have no shot to win. But that's something that will come up in a couple years at the next labor negotiation.
Good talking to you, Tim. Appreciate it.
Okay, Colin. See ya.
Rob Nyer, ESPN.com, baseball writer. Rob, I'm going to break all the rules when it comes to ESPN. Are you prepared for this? I'm going to break all the rules.
No, I'm not prepared, but go ahead anyway. It's your show.
Question number one is going to be about the Washington Nationals. Yes, the Washington Nationals, they are 6-6. They're my favorite surprise of this season. What do you think it means for their future? Do you think that there is any real to what they are doing? And what do you think it means about Steven Strasburg and how it could change the way they play that going forward?
Well, the only thing that could possibly change the Strasburg situation is if the Nationals were serious contenders or even moderate contenders. And we can't say that about them yet. I don't think internally they see themselves that way. I mean, they've been outscored by 17 runs, which is close to the worst in the National League, or second worst. And I just think they're still focused on growth. I also think, though, that on paper, the Nationals are not as bad as everyone thought they would be coming in. And same was true last year, and they wound up being worse. But one of these years, they're going to have a decent season. They're going to win 75 or 80 games. And I don't know if it's this year or not, but this is not a disastrous franchise. I mean, they made a lot of mistakes, sure, but there is some talent there.
Is there a reason for, you said if they would only change the Strasburg idea and call him up early if they were in contention or if they thought they were going to contend, but is the value of the Nationals winning 82 to 85 games and coming in third place in the NL East, is that worth it to them in terms of the interest that they could generate in that city, especially with Strasburg on the major league team?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think attendance goes up much if they're on track for a 500 season. Fans just don't really respond to that. Fans respond to contenders. They respond to, and even sometimes not even that. Sometimes it takes being better. It takes being exciting. And Strasburg, they would be exciting with Strasburg on the mound, but the rest of the time, not really so much. So I just see them sticking to their timetable, and that means probably not bringing him up until mid-May, even early June, to save some money.
Rob, what surprised you so far about this first couple of weeks of the baseball season?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to surprise me early in the season, but I think the Red Sox struggling to the extent that they have has to be a little surprising to people. I don't know. I mean, you look around the rest of the standings. I mean, the Giants have played better than anybody expected. They have the very near the best run differential in the National League. That's impressive. They've been better than I thought they would be. But again, I really don't look at the standings with any seriousness until mid-May, probably.
Well, I agree. I don't think you need to look at the standings and say, all right, the Red Sox have started slow and therefore they're not going to be in contention this year. But certainly we can look at the AL East and say, all right, the Yankees look to be the team they were last year, or at least something similar. The Rays look like they might be the best team in baseball. And if the Red Sox let themselves get too deep in a hole, it may be very difficult for them to come out of it.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, I tired fairly quickly this last winter and this spring of people saying, oh, it's the Yankees and the Red Sox, nobody else has a chance. That's nuts. I mean, on paper, the Yankees were a 95, 96, 97 win team. The Red Sox may be a tick behind them. And sure, but the Rays were not that far behind those two teams, and we've seen in the past it doesn't take a lot for a team that's four or five games behind on paper to to do a lot better than people think. And so the Rays entered the season as a contender. They're a contender now, and you're absolutely right. If the Yankees or the Red Sox falter just a little bit and drop to, say, 90-91 wins on the season, the Rays could well take advantage.
You know, one of the things that we're talking to Rob Neyer of ESPN.com here on All Night ESPN Radio. Rob, one of the things, and I can't call this a surprise, but it's just sort of something pleasant about baseball right now. We spend so much time talking about what's wrong with this game. There's a lot right with the game of baseball right now, whether it's the stars that came into the league a few years ago, the Joe Mauers, the Evan Longorias, the Ryan Brauns, who I think are just now starting to hit their stride and really becoming some of the best players in the game. Between that group and this next group of young stars, the Matt Wieters, the Steven Strasburgs, when he finally comes up, along with Aroldis Chapman, Jason Hayward is already making news. There is a really elite group of, and I want to stress this word, athletes that are coming up right now in baseball.
You bet. I think that's absolutely true. And we tend to fall in this trap of thinking that the game's in trouble. You know, sometimes it's, what happened to all the good catchers? Or what happened to all the pitchers who could throw 95? Well, I'll tell you what, right now, in both of those groups, we're loaded. And, those things tend to be cyclical, but whether you talk about the great athletes going to play basketball or more often, I think, football or whatever, there are lots of great athletes on this planet. Many of them in the Western Hemisphere play baseball. And between Venezuela and the Dominican Republic and now Cuba, is obviously we're getting a lot more Cuban players lately, not to mention the 300 million Americans in the U.S. There's no shortage of athletic talent, and plenty of it is heading toward baseball for us to have a lot of great players to watch for as far as you can imagine.
And now that we're in this post-steroid era, the athletes become a whole lot more important. There's more running in the game, at least in theory. Defense becomes more important. Not everybody can just sit back and wait for the 3-run home run. Yesterday, we saw pitching really take center stage in two different games. There's a 20-inning game. It's no score throughout 18, and finally 2-1 the final. You also have a no-hitter by Ubaldo Jimenez of the Colorado Rockies. As a baseball fan and writer, which of those two stories get you more excited?
Oh, I say the 20. I love marathons. I mean, I actually wasn't home, wasn't with my TV, so I didn't get to watch the game. But if I would have, I love those marathons. I mean, I'll stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever it takes. I think the Jimenez game is more significant though, because it really tells us something interesting about him, and also about the Rockies. I think the Rockies win the division by a couple of games over, I think, the Dodgers this season. And they may not win it, who knows. But Jimenez is still young, has a chance to establish himself as one of the best pitchers in the National League. And one game doesn't do that. Not many pitchers who aren't real good pitchers are able to do what he did. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about him.
All right, good stuff. Rob Neyer, ESPN.com. Read him there. Rob, always good to talk to you. We'll do it again.
Sounds good. Take care, Mike.